I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of June 24th, 2011. Long gone are the days when renters had the upper hand. Now, it is a landlord's market.
So if you wanted to offer whatever your terms are to make yourself more desirable, that's up to you. Okay. You put it on the application, I present that to the owner, and then from there we proceed.
We'll explore the new housing landscape for renters. In just a few weeks, Congress has to decide whether or not to raise the debt ceiling. Why should you care?
I hadn't given it a thought. I knew it would affect the country, but it never occurred to me it might affect me personally or how it would.
We'll find out what a national default would mean for the average American. And it takes a lot to find a job these days. Do you know what your brand promise is?
If you can establish a brand early and let it evolve and stay focused on it, I don't think it takes a ton of time at all. In fact, you can live your brand just like you live your life in a very authentic way.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
It is not so hard to remember the days when landlords couldn't give apartments away because everyone wanted a house, right? Well, fast forward 3 to 4 years, and this month, the UCLA Anderson forecast said Southern Californians are more likely to pick apartments in urban areas over McMansions in the suburbs, and that's pushing rental prices up. Same's happening from New York to Charleston to Houston. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports it is a landlord's game now.
Craig Gaines and Erica Wrightson are your typical renters. He's 32, she's 26. They're shopping for their first place together in Los Angeles. Today, they're looking at a cozy 800-square-foot bungalow.
We thought the rooms were maybe just a tiny bit small.
And apparently, the previous tenants had a thing for sponge paint.
If we're going to be paying $1,850, which is what it was listed at, we wanted the inside to be just a little bit nicer.
Rental agent Ellie Balderrama says last year this place would have gone for $1,700 a month. But since the spring,
it's been madness. Prices have gone up and they're renting faster.
During the recession, apartment construction slowed to a crawl. That's limited the supply of new units just as more people are looking. Some are relocating to take new jobs. Others who lost or sold their homes have decided to rent. When Balderrama shows up at a weekend open house in L.A.'s trendy Silver Lake neighborhood, a crowd is already waiting.
Hi, guys. Come on up.
She opens the gate to a two-bedroom cottage listed at $2,600 a month.
It's just now 12:30 and we've already had 5 parties come through.
Many have applications in hand. By 12:45, prospective tenants start adding sweeteners to their applications. 3 months rent up front, bigger deposits.
Obviously, there are tons of people checking this place out.
So if you wanted to offer whatever your terms are to make yourself more desirable, that's up to you.
Okay.
You put it on the application, I present that to the owner, and then from there we proceed.
Wait a minute. Landlords want renters to be more desirable now? Douglas Pope of the housing site HotPads.com says that's a huge shift for tenants who've gotten used to being in the power position.
You didn't even actually have to ask for deals. You know, when you signed a lease, they automatically gave you the first 2 months rent-free and, maybe they threw in a TV.
Rental units on HotPads have shot up almost 7% in the last year. Pope says that's partly because new renters are moving in and the older ones aren't moving on. 55-year-old Greg Richardson and his wife sold a 4-bedroom house 2 years ago. While they were looking for their next place, they took a 2-bedroom apartment.
This is essentially the second bedroom, which is set up as an office, except the dresser only fits in here.
The apartment may be a little cramped, but the rent is half of what they paid on a mortgage. Richardson is using the savings to start a consulting business, and they plan to keep renting.
I think it's a challenge because you feel like you're going backwards in some ways. But if you just look at the nuts and bolts of the situation, it made a lot of sense for us.
The nuts and bolts being the fact that your expenses are like half.
Yes, big nuts and bolts like that.
those nuts and bolts have many house hunters asking the big rent or buy question again. Bob Bridges teaches real estate finance at the University of Southern California.
It isn't really a question of whether you should rent or buy. The question is, should you buy or should you take the equivalent amount of money and invest in something else?
Bridges' research shows if you invest wisely, and that's the key word, you can make out better as a renter. Craig Gaines, the guy apartment hunting with his girlfriend, is glad he doesn't have to make that decision.
I'm in no huge rush to buy a house.
And with most of the country in his camp, open houses for rentals will probably get much more crowded. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
And for another take on the rental market, on our Making Money blog, we look at the surge in low-income families who pay 50% or more of their income on rent and utilities. And now a little red meat for home owners. We all know that a home's value is whatever a buyer and seller can agree on, but that doesn't stop us from sometimes wondering what it's worth. And over the last few years for that, we've turned to various online services like Zillow.com. Well, this week, Zillow changed the way it calculates value, and some of us had a hard time believing what we were seeing. So we invited Stan Humphries on the show to explain. He is Zillow's chief economist. Good to talk to you again.
Hi, Tess. Thanks for having me again.
So Zillow changed the algorithm that it uses to calculate home values this week. What changed?
So in terms of what changed, well, before I guess I get into that, just a higher level understanding what the Zestimate is. Again, it's a Zestimate, so it's an estimate of home values. It's designed to be a starting point for consumers to use in having a conversation about the value of their home. In terms of what changed, so last week we rolled out a new set of algorithms that produce those Zestimates. And those algorithms achieved a number of things, important things around better coverage. We added about 25 million homes to the website that have values. And we substantially improved the accuracy of the algorithm. It's now about 33% more accurate than it was before.
Well, the reason this caught my attention this week is because I've been monitoring Zillow and my own home value because we're thinking of doing a refi on our house in Pasadena, California. So I just happened to go to Zillow this week, and I had to pick my jaw up off the floor after seeing that the home value had changed by six figures and not in a positive direction. And the last time I checked was less than 2 months ago. So can you possibly explain what might have happened there?
Yeah. So in general, we had some Zestimates that went up and some Zestimates that went down. And in general, the movements were fairly modest. Most mm-hmm. were under 10% and change, but some did see larger changes. And it's important, to remember that this is an estimate of home value. The true price that attaches to a home can only be settled when a buyer and seller come into agreement on the price of a home.
Sure. Or you get an appraisal.
That's correct, right. So it's, you know, the Zestimate is designed to be a starting point where you, you know, is an input into a conversation that there'll be other inputs as well.
Okay, with all those caveats, how is it possible to have a property price move by that significant of an amount? And I'll tell you, you know, I went on Twitter to ask my followers if anyone else had noticed this. And, you know, for example, one of them came back and said that actually theirs had changed by six figures as well on the upside. So they were very pleased about that. But it just seems like such an enormous jump. Is it purely this new algorithm that explains this?
Well, a key part of the new algorithm is that we designed it so that it puts more weight on more recent transactions so that it's better able to track what's happening right now in your local area. And that's in some areas that have been rapidly moving. That is a reason why you could potentially see some larger changes. So, for example, in Pasadena, that's a market that did see considerable stabilization in prices in a lot of 2009, 2010. In fact, saw about five quarters in a row of positive appreciation. And then when the federal home buyer tax credits lapsed in the middle part of 2010, started to see significant depreciation again. So this algorithm is able to better track that depreciation that's happening in the market.
So you're looking at a combination of both the new algorithm and really very recent market changes as well.
That's correct, right.
Well, let's talk about the impact of Zillow's Zestimates. You know, I know that they are not an appraisal, but I also do know for a fact that buyers and sellers use that number as a bargaining chip. They're kind of like almost like a Kelley Blue Book for property. Maybe they shouldn't be, but they are. And that means that this kind of change can really take a toll, can't it?
You're right that buyers are using the Zestimate, but I think they're using it in conjunction with a number of other data points. For example, recently sold data from the website, as well as I think they're obviously working with local real estate agents and appraisers typically as well. And I think buyers are smart. I mean, they've done a lot of research. Typically, buyers who are in the market have been in a lot of homes in the area in which they're looking. And ultimately, if they want a home that they've fallen in love with, they'll pay what it takes, mm-hmm. regardless of what the zestment is on that home. So I don't think that while I think that the zestment is a useful bit of information in their home shopping process and in their thinking, I don't believe that homeowners are not buying homes for prices above the zestimate.
All right. Stan Humphries is the chief economist for Zillow. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tess, for having me.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Every few weeks, the parking lot of the Pasadena Rose Bowl is turned into one of the biggest flea markets in the country. People come from all over Southern California to browse through junk, clutter, stuff, also known to some of them as found treasure. And if you have an eye for that kind of thing, you truly can get bargains galore on things you'll not only use, but will potentially be able to sell down the line. Vintage. That is the key. Well, commentator Zach Bissonette has one of those eyes, and he says if we all developed a taste for old treasures, we might just get ourselves out of the consumer spending spiral we've been in these last few decades.
I decided to become an antique dealer because I was too young to get a real job. I spent countless hours scrolling through sold items on eBay to become an expert on vintage video games, records, and first edition books. In sixth grade, I bought a new-in-the-box Magnavox Odyssey, the first home video game system from 1972, at a thrift shop for $2. I sold it for $710. A 25-cent Robert Parker first edition brought $130, and a 50-cent promo copy of Igor May's Blame It on the Bossa Nova album sold for $26 to someone in Japan. I no longer buy and sell antiques and collectibles with any regularity. But I decided I would furnish my first place the way I'd always dreamed of, with stuff at country auctions, yard sales, and flea markets. Not only is it fun, good for the environment, and more interesting than a living room that looks like an IKEA catalog, but it's also a better investment. But aren't antiques a really bad investment? One of my friends, a financial journalist, asked me. Here's my answer. The best financial decision would be to live without furniture or art. But since most of us don't want to live with no furniture or bare walls, buying used is the next best thing. Still better is to pay a good price for something vintage, something that could possibly even go up in value. And while no one can predict with certainty what the future holds for Chippendale chairs or the vintage TV lamps my mother spends approximately 4 hours per day researching on eBay, we do know this. They'll hold their value better than a particle board coffee table from Target.
Zach Bissonette is the author of Debt-Free You, How I Paid for an Outstanding College Education Without Loans, Scholarship, or Mooching Off My Parents. And now you know exactly how he did it. Send us your comments. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact or post on our Facebook page. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is David Lazarus, personal finance columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, David.
I like the way you say that with so much zest.
Los Angeles Times. David Lazarus.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let's get serious here. You may remember that last time you were on the show, we talked about this study that found that half of Americans are unable to come up with $2,000 for an emergency fund. Remember that?
I do.
Okay. Well, you and I expressed dismay at that fact.
And chagrin.
Well, here is what Lisa Carlson had to say. She's in Astoria, Oregon.
I'm sorry, but these hosts do not live in the same world I live in. Most people I know do not have $200 for an emergency. Housing comes first. Food only lasts the first couple of weeks until a trip to the food bank. Maybe you should attempt to talk to people and find out for yourself.
And here's Hillary Johnson from Minneapolis.
I'm a regular listener to your show. Judging by your content, your target audience is not the average working class American, and that's fine. But it is your responsibility as journalists focusing on personal money issues to at least be aware that lots of people are poor.
Okay. So my first response is we are aware of that. And I don't think that we were surprised so much as you said, chagrined. Because the fact is that if you cannot set aside any money, all we're saying is you could find yourself in really big trouble.
Yeah,
right?
I think it's the same sense of frustration that we express anytime we speak with someone who isn't prepared for their retirement, for example.
Right.
What's interesting, I think, about some of the responses that we got was there was an implication that we were being insensitive.
Right.
And that there's a lot of good, honest, working stiffs out there who are just living paycheck to paycheck, and we don't really walk a mile in their shoes. And, you know, to be honest, no, I think, you know, we really do understand. I mean, we do deal with a lot of people working day in, day out, and we get it.
Well, and in fact, and on this show, that's what we do. We're talking to a lot of people in this segment in particular who are wondering how they're going to get by.
Yeah, but it's worth pointing out that this show's default setting is managing your money.
Right.
And there's a presumption that there is some money to manage. Now, that's not to say that everybody's got $2,000 sitting under their mattress or sitting in their pocket looking for some sort of investment or some sort of home.
Right. And I guess what we're saying is that we encourage everyone to try to get to that point. Now, yes, it may be inconceivable to think that you can save $10 a month, but whatever you can do to get yourself to that point, even $5 a month is going to be better than nothing. And in fact, this very week, Bankrate released a poll that found that 24% of Americans have no emergency savings.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're not terribly surprised by that fact, but it is alarming. Because the social safety net is not necessarily as robust as it used to be in this country. All we're saying is do what you can.
There are savings to be had out there. You just have to go for what's within reach.
All right. Let's head to the phones. And Jenny is with us from right here in Los Angeles. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
What do you do here in L.A.?
Oh, I work in the music business.
Are you a musician?
No, actually, I work in promotion. So I work with artists on getting them played on radio stations.
Well, how can we help you out today?
About 6 years ago, I purchased my parents' property in Montana. Hmm. I live in California. My parents live in Montana. And there was some financial issues going on with my parents at the time where they were at risk of losing the place. I've reached a point where I can't really sustain this any longer. And so what I'm looking at is a couple of different options in terms of how do I get out of this.
Tell us a little bit about what kind of mortgage you assumed. You're on the title?
Yes. I have a 30-year fixed interest only loan that I've been paying on.
30-year fixed interest only?
Mm-hmm.
You must have a limited number of years that's interest only.
Yeah, and I'm in the portion where I have, you know, you get your option payment where you can pay this much, or this much every month to stay current.
Oh, good Lord, you have an option arm?
I think so. My question to you guys is, how can I get out of this? I have a payoff amount of $412,000.
$412,000.
Yep, on an interest rate of 6.75%.
So mom and dad are still living there?
Yeah, they're still living there, and it's a pretty remote location. It's a, you know, long story short is it was a retirement plan that didn't work out. And I was under the impression that I'd be able to keep the place for them until they could fix it, and my dad was not able to fix it.
You have assumed the title to a home that has a $412,000 mortgage on it.
Right.
And you're wondering how you can get out of this property with your shirt on.
Yeah.
And then somehow make good for your parents.
I could take better care of them with the money I'm spending every month on this payment by just physically putting them in a rental property somewhere.
How much are you paying per month?
It's about $2,300 a month.
It's a lot.
Do you have any idea what the home is worth right now?
I had a real estate agent look at the place, and he gave me a BPO of a list price of about $395.
Okay, so that means that the home is potentially underwater.
Yes, and I also have a private buyer who's interested in the place for substantially less than that.
So you're talking about a short sale?
If the bank would approve the short sale.
Do you have a plan? I mean, is there something that you're leaning towards to remedy this problem?
I mean, I would love to be able to sell it to this guy who wants to buy it, even though what he wants to buy it for is a lot less than what I owe if the bank would accept those short sale terms. But I don't know whether or not they will, and I'm a little unsure as to how to approach them.
I will tell you one thing, which is that short sales are taking a long time to get done these days.
Yeah. If they get done.
If they get done at all.
They want to see if they can work with you, the devil they know, as opposed to the devil they don't. They do not want to take a loss on a property if they can help it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, in your corner is the fact they don't want to foreclose on you either because they have a huge backlog right now of foreclosed properties.
Yeah.
So there's an incentive there for them to work with you. And that means that a short sale remains a possibility, but a more likely chance would be a loan mod. That potentially could bring that interest rate down from the sixes where you are now down to the fours where it should be at the moment, considering current market rates.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that on your side, is that you're just paying way above market rates right now.
I also am looking at my job and my work and understanding the nature of the economy right now and thinking ahead as to, like, you know, how much longer am I sure that I'm going to have the income that I have? And does it make any sense for me to keep making these payments?
What Jenny is now asking us is about walking away.
Right.
You know, it's a question that only you can answer, but there are serious financial consequences for you if you are to do that. It leaves a black mark on your record for a long time.
And you should also keep in mind that if you do a short sale, there will also be a black mark on your record, but you will bounce back from that quicker than you will from a foreclosure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Contact the bank that has your mortgage.
Yeah.
Tell them what's up. Tell them that you want to be looking at a potential loan modification.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell them in the same breath, and I'm interested in exploring a short sale.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that they know where you're going and they'll also have some incentive for the loan mod.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hearing the frustration in your voice. Remember that you're not alone in this. There are there are a lot of people
Millions.
In a similar situation.
Okay. All right. I appreciate your help. Thanks for your time.
Deep breath. Good luck.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Let's go now to Manina from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Manina.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm very good. Thank you.
What do you do there in Eugene?
I just graduated from the University of Oregon with a degree in geography.
You going to make maps?
Hopefully. I'm a former RN, and I think what I want to do is I want to position in some type of humanitarian organization.
Wow.
Working with cartography and disaster relief and public health.
That is, like, so cool.
To have a nurse go into geography to then work in humanitarian assistance.
A little different.
Nurse by day, crime fighter by night.
Exactly.
Crime fighter?
Exactly.
Where did you get that?
It just sounds better. The cartography thing gets you only so far, and then there has to be gunplay. You know,
here
it's Hollywood.
All right. Well, let's move away from the gunplay and see how we can help you out with your finances.
Let's map something
great.
Out.
Let's map. Oh,
thank you,
David.
Always thinking ahead.
Okay. I got a call from my 88-year-old mother-in-law, and she would like to give a financial gift for our son's college education. He will be entering college in 2012, that fall. So my question is this. She wanted me to find out what is the best way for her to give approximately $11,000 in a CD that she has that comes due in March of 2012 and in one of her checking accounts that's $9,000. So she wants to know what is the best way for her to give that financial gift for his education without her suffering a tax penalty or any kind of liability that will affect her or affect my husband and myself.
Well, this is a pretty easy one, David.
I'm thinking as much, too.
Yeah.
Because it was confusing for me when I called the IRS. I was very confused.
Oh, well, they shouldn't have confused you because you do have the ability each year to give away a certain amount of money. And I believe it's $13,000 a year at this point that you can give away tax-free, no liability on the part of the recipient or the giver to each individual. So like if you had two kids, she could give a certain amount of money to one and a certain amount of money to the other.
I do have two kids.
Okay, well, there you go.
But there's another option here, too, and that is mom-in-law opens up her own 529 account. And a 529 is a education savings plan, and it's a tax shelter. And so she's able to have money there sheltered from taxes until it's used.
Is one of those choices better than another?
Well, it depends because Tess is saying is there's an annual limit on the gift. And
right.
So you kind of have to have a little game plan in terms of how much is going to be bequeathed every year. With the 529, mom-in-law/grandma can put as much as she wants annually into the 529, and it can grow, it can compound, and maybe work for you a little more. tax-free.
Certainly, if there is more money that it, that potentially is going to be coming that you want to have in there for a while.
And to grow and compound.
Then you would definitely want to be looking at a 529 plan versus just a cash gift.
I see. This has been great information. This is exactly what I was looking for, and I can call her and now lay it all out so she can pick what she likes.
Well, that sounds like a great plan.
Okay, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for the call. And finally, we have Jet from Levine, Arizona. Hi, Jet.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What's going on with you? What do you do there in Arizona?
I teach 7th and 8th grade. I teach social studies.
All right.
That's a pretty good age, isn't it?
I love it.
It's a great age. It's also a great subject for that age because kids are really, you know, receptive to those lessons.
Yeah, they really are. So they want to change the world, and it's lucky that we have social studies because they can get out and figure out how.
Well, I love that.
What do you recommend? How should they change the world?
voting, number one.
Yeah,
amen.
Thank you. Yes.
All right. So what kind of financial woes are you dealing with?
Well, I just got engaged.
Well, that's lovely.
And that's not a woe. We should back that up. That's a good thing.
That's a woo.
Hey, woohoo.
Thank you.
And
thank
wooing.
You. And we're looking to get married June of next year, so about a year from now. I have an old 401k from a job I worked maybe 7 or 8 years ago that I have about $3,600 in that I'm looking, as terrible as I've heard it is, into cashing it out.
No.
Wait. Is this your only 401k?
No, I have a state retirement through the state because I'm a teacher. So, and there's close to like 8,000 in that.
How old are you?
26.
I don't know. Well, right off the bat, I say no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in an emergency, in an absolute emergency, I would say, you know, it's your money. You got to do what you got to do. Mm-hmm. But that $3,600 that's sitting there, do you know how much that's going to be worth by the time you're 65?
Yeah, I plugged it into a calculator and saw. So.
And?
I think it was close to like 80, 90,000.
There you go.
There you go. Oh. How hard would it be to put the wedding on the credit card?
My credit card is almost maxed out. I used it to help me get through college to buy, you know, groceries and books and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do we have to have a super expensive wedding?
No. But the thing is, we're about as far as we can get with cutting out guests or inviting guests, at least. And we're looking probably right around 100 people.
Let me ask this. What kind of budget are you looking at?
Probably around 10 or 11,000.
Okay. Well, that's not bad.
Yeah, but I don't think you need to have that big a wedding, to be honest. I mean, for getting hitched, especially when you're young. And you're just starting out.
Starting off your marriage with debt from a wedding just is not fun.
What I'm going to recommend is you try to be perhaps a little more creative here. For example, even for just a short spell working a second job as a possibility. I mean, you're a teacher. In theory, that's going to open up summers for you and you know, some other times perhaps you and she could perhaps scrimp and save and work a little harder for a little bit to raise that money. And even though it sounds really perverse, in a way, it's kind of romantic, the idea of really knuckling down to try to give yourselves the start in life that you want without taking on any extra burden, in other words, any extra debt.
Okay.
Amen.
I don't think he's buying this at all.
Maybe not.
I really am buying it. That's the thing that kind of is making me lean towards cashing it out, though. I mean, I bought a house a year ago. I have my student loans. I have my credit card. So I'm really trying to avoid getting further into debt. But I definitely do, you know, see that in, you know, 40 years when I'm ready to retire, it would be nice to have that, you know, $80,000.
I hate the idea of you taking that money out and losing potentially, you know, close to $100,000 off your retirement.
And it's just not a good start to what should be the happiest day of your life.
Yep. And remember, anyone who comes to your wedding, all they're going to remember and care about is whether you had fun.
Okay. Definitely. That helped a lot. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Yes.
Well, enjoy the wedding planning. It'll be a fun year for you.
Perfect.
And send us a picture?
I will, for sure.
Okay.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Thanks so much, Jet.
You're welcome.
All right. We are here to take your money questions. Give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You can find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. David, thanks as always for being here.
My pleasure.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
because of your giant wallet. Just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
I'm Brian Morton from New York. I'm actually a professor at Barnard College.
What's in my wallet?
Nothing out of the ordinary. My ID card, Metro card, debit, my credit card, then my online credit card. I only use this one for online purchases, so if anybody gets a hold of the number, I can dump it. My Joe Coffee card and my Good Beer New York City gift certificate card. It's a great store. They sell hundreds of craft brews from around the States mostly, but I think they have a few international ones. So you can buy single bottles and sample dozens of different craft brews. Fantastic store. And an old, old picture of my wife. She won't mind. It's a picture of her when I first met her many years ago. I think it's a passport photo. She had an extra copy and gave it to me. She was just on her way to Europe. We had met in Toronto. She was leaving in a couple months for Europe, so she gave me her passport photo. And then we got married a while after that. So that's what's in my wallet.
Negotiations over raising the nation's debt limit and cutting the deficit are in overdrive. Now, if wrangling over the debt ceiling makes your eyes glaze over, it's probably because you're thinking, nah, it really doesn't have anything to do with my daily existence. But if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling by this August deadline, your wallet could indeed take a hit. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to explain.
Patty Crow lives in Northern Virginia. She's agreed to sit down and talk about her financial life and how it intersects with the debt ceiling debate. I brought Stuart Ritter with me. He's a financial planner with T. Rowe Price. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Very nice to meet you.
Nice
this is Stuart Ritter.
Hi, Patty. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, sir.
How are you?
Oh, gorgeous house.
Wow.
As we walk in, we admire the paintings lining the walls, mostly done by Crow's husband, Ira, an artist and carpenter. She's a publisher. Their story is probably a lot like yours. They have a mortgage and some other debt. I ask Crow what she thinks would happen to her finances if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling and the U.S. defaults.
I hadn't given it a thought. I knew it would affect the country, but it never occurred to me it might affect me personally or how it would.
How much you could be affected by a U.S. default depends on a number of things. Where you live, what kind of debt you have. The financial planner, Stuart Ritter, says the government would have to pay higher interest rates if it defaulted, and those higher rates would be contagious, pushing up borrowing costs for consumers.
All of these interest rates are interconnected. It's not as if each is existing in isolation of the other. So generally, interest rates overall will move up and down together.
Patty Crow cringes as Ritter says this. Like many consumers, the Crows rely on credit cards when things get tough. Their son had brain surgery a few years ago. Their insurance didn't cover everything. They used their credit cards to pay the hospital bill. Crow won't say how much they owe. Ritter tells her, pay down that credit card, because the bank will probably raise that rate if the government defaults.
If interest rates do go up, that one would probably react most quickly. So the less you have of that credit card debt, the less that kind of thing will affect you.
Ritter advises Crow to pay down the credit cards with her home equity line of credit. That has a lower interest rate right now. In fact, he says the Crows should always use their line of credit in emergencies, like a drop-off in business. Crow's publishing company wasn't affected much by the recession. She mainly prints textbooks, which are always in demand, and the Washington area never felt the worst effects of the recession. Ira Crow's carpentry business did slow down a bit last summer. It's picking up again, but now he needs a new work van.
So it's not a question of do we want to, but will we have to, or he'll be carrying his ladders on his back.
So the Crows will be shouldering a new car loan in the next few months, and they could pay a higher rate because of the shadow of default. Stuart Ritter tells Crow, prepare for that possibility now.
Sit down and go through a prioritization process. What is it that we're going to have to give up if we're going to be spending more money on the loan? Where is that extra money going to come from?
Patty Crow says she'll cut back, but she's not sure where. The Crows don't have a lot of extra cash. They're in their 50s and haven't saved much for retirement. Investments wouldn't help them anyway during a default. Stocks would take a hit. So would the dollar. And that has immediate implications for the Crows. Investors would dump the dollar and switch to commodities like oil, bidding up the price. Gas would go up. Patty Crow says that wouldn't make her husband Ira happy. He drives a lot for his business.
He'll spend maybe $100 a week on gas. So, you know, he complains about it. It's a big bill.
It's dawning on Patty Crow that a default could affect her more than she thinks.
You know, the truth is, it's the little things that add up to becoming big things that make life harder financially sometimes. So, you know, I can see that it could have an effect.
It's just this kind of realization that puts a dent in consumer confidence. A default on top of that could push us back into recession, just when consumers like Patty Crow are trying to find their financial footing. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace Money.
You may remember last week, Liz Weston and I discussed a blog post over at U.S. News & World Report. It talked about how we all need to know what our brand promise is. I practically spat the words brand promise. I am not a brand. I am a person. And yet, I grudgingly admit that the author of that blog post, marketing and career coach Tim Terrell Smith, has a point.
Really, a brand promise is your reason why. Why should I hire you? Why should I buy your service or product? It's really what separates you from others doing the same job, looking for the same job, or selling a product or service that's very similar.
You gotta be able to sell yourself. So we invited you to write us for help with your brand promise. And Tim joins us now to provide that help. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tess. Great to be here.
Well, let me tell you, you know, as you know, we mentioned this on the program last week, and I revealed myself as a bit of a skeptic about this, at least this term. And, you know, we did go on Facebook and Twitter and ask people about this. And, you know, one person on Facebook said living as a constant brand is no way to live a life. Darsha Savvy on Facebook said, when do I have time to get my actual work done if I'm spending all this time building my personal brand? So let me ask you to address this skepticism.
You know, I think that a lot of people have never experienced something like a job search or starting something from scratch where you really truly have to do a great job introducing who you are and what you do. Usually I get the biggest pushback from people who have never been out of work, because when you have been out of work or you've tried to start like a new business, everybody walks up to you and says, so tell me about yourself. Tell me why I should hire you. And I think that if you can establish a brand early and let it evolve and stay focused on it, I don't think it takes a ton of time at all. In fact, you can live your brand just like you live your life in a very authentic way. I think it's something that everybody should really consider, especially in this new world where we have Twitter, we have Facebook. Very quickly, people are learning or not learning something about you.
All right. Well, you know, we asked some of our listeners to write in and tell us why they needed help creating a brand promise. And Rick Richards from Sacramento, California is on the phone. He wrote to us on Facebook. Rick, meet Tim.
Hello, Tim.
Hey, Rick.
All right. So, Rick, tell us what Tim can help you with.
Well, Tim, I had opened a photography business in the beginning of 2008. And first half of the year went great. Second half of the year, like a lot of businesses, it nosedived and crashed and burned with the economy. So I am back on the road driving truck cross country, but I don't want to do it the rest of my life, and I do want to get back into the photography business.
Tim, walk us through that process of helping Rick figuring out what his brand promise is.
What I would like to do is I'd like to understand, what aspect of photography do you love, and how can you take that aspect and turn it into something that allows people to truly understand why you? Is there a type of photography that you do better than anybody else? That needs to be communicated.
So, Tim, is this then more about what his skills are, or is it about his passion? Is this a one-liner that, hi, I'm Rick, and this is what I love?
Well, let me give you an example. The positioning or brand statement that I use when I talk about my marketing coaching business is, I help people do great things in a short amount of time. So it's aspirational, and it also gives people specifics about what I can do for them. I don't know, Rick, if you're on Twitter, but if you're on Twitter, you've got 140 characters to get a point across.
Right.
And I would think about that in real life.
Okay. Like a 30-second interview. And
exactly.
With that elevator speech. And
Yeah. Tim, is this kind of your elevator speech? Is that what your brand promise is?
It's part of it. I would include my brand promise as a way to introduce my elevator pitch. It's the first words that come out of my mouth, and I use the rest of my pitch to deliver my personality and deliver some details that are compelling and support that brand promise.
All right, Rick, you have your marching orders.
All right, thank you.
All right, now next up we have John Decker, and he's a visual effects artist here in Los Angeles. Hey, John.
Hey, Tess. Hi, Tim.
Hey, John.
Now, you wrote in because you told us that the thought of branding yourself makes you feel icky.
Yes. Our industry is going very, very freelance, and so more than ever, you have to be prepared to present yourself to people who may not know who you are, sort of, you know, in many cases, every 6 months or every 9 months or at least once a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of start to self-edit when I have to market myself, and then I feel like, oh, man, I'm like being total, like, you know, advertiser guy, and I've got to, it just starts to feel so icky.
Tim, really, I think the question here is, what is a way to pitch yourself, certainly with confidence, and but not being irritating or seeming completely self-centered?
Well, I think one of the ways that I do that personally is I ask a lot of questions. So when I'll meet somebody for the first time, I will start asking them questions and spend no time at all talking about myself. And as I learn about other people, I can learn about where I can adapt my message to that particular person. You know, if I ask somebody a few questions about what's the last favorite movie you've seen, and I know, for example, John, that you worked on Alvin the Chipmunks, Night at the Museum, if they mention some of those movies, I could go, oh, interesting, that's what I do for a living. And you start just a really interesting dynamic conversation based on what's happening with them, not with you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what you were saying, Tim, about sort of, you know, when you're in the conversation presenting yourself. I think where I sort of hit the stumbling block is that in many cases, I have to sell myself before I get a chance to actually meet this person or talk to them, because you're sending out the demo reel and the resume, and you have to somehow rise to the top of the pile and get them to call you in for that first conversation.
Well, you bring up a really important point. It's called social credibility. And what that means is that before you have even sent your information off, someone is aware of you, aware of something that you've done, aware of they've seen a tweet of yours, they've seen your Facebook page. John, I went and saw your personal website, and on your personal website, I watched your reel. But I also saw a lot of other stuff that I thought was perhaps distracting, the updates on your house, the trip to China.
Uh-oh.
I would like to see your personal website be totally focused on your reel, your passion for film, visual effects. Mm-hmm. That to me says, I mean, that was really powerful when I watched the stuff that you were involved in.
Mm. Okay.
Fascinating.
It's about building up that social credibility by introducing yourself to people, exposing your brand. I don't know if you have your reel on your iPhone, if you have a smartphone. I'd be, you know, showing people that all the time, because that really sells it for me, is just seeing those amazing scenes that you either built or were a big part of.
Tim, it sounds like it is kind of a one-liner. This is your tagline.
Yeah, I went to your sites, your Facebook, if you had it, all that stuff. And John, as I thought through all the stuff that I wrote about you, something like, I make movies more interesting. It's probably not the right words exactly, but that compels me. That gets me leaning in a little bit and makes me wonder what you mean by that.
Hmm.
Unless you have a brand promise that you're actively telling people, your brand is what people say it is, right? If you don't act to manage your own brand, others will decide it for you.
All right. Well, thanks so much for chatting with us.
Thank you very much, Tess. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome.
All right, Tim, I almost hesitate to ask you this because I'm a little afraid of the answer. Did you find anything about me that shouldn't be out there?
You know, I haven't done my full research on you, Tess. I did read your bio. And one of the things I would say about you is I love your Twitter stream because you are actively engaging with your listeners. I'm assuming many of them are listeners. You're also retweeting a lot of stuff. And that's what people want social media to be, is a chance to meet you and to get to know you and to hear maybe some comments about how your day was. I mean, that's interesting for someone like you, who you are a brand, like it or not.
I suppose I am. All right. Tim Terrell Smith is a career strategist and a blogger for U.S. News and World Report. His latest book is Headstrong, The Keys to a Confident and Positive Attitude During the Job Search. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been fun.
Thanks, Tess.
And in case you didn't pick it up yet, you can find Tim and me on Twitter and Facebook. And because of their willingness to explore their brand promise on the air with us, Rick and John are this week's recipients of the Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue friend is heading in two directions with our thanks and good luck wishes for both these gentlemen who are looking for steady work in their areas of expertise and passion. The Piggy's brand promise is simple. Put money in me, and I will hold it for safekeeping. By the way, if you want a pig, be my 2,000th follower on Twitter. It has been a while, so let's take a look at the inbox. And Megan Larson is with us. She's been producing the show the past couple of weeks. Hey, Megan.
Wow, this is kind of exciting to share the stage, or well, the studio with you. I am normally a behind-the-scenes kind of gal, whispering in your ears.
All right, well, now you can speak right into the microphone. Now, what do we have this week? Righteous indignation, comments, compliments?
Well, some of all, I would say.
Okay.
Mostly righteous indignation, however, over your interview last week with the Sinclairs.
Ah, this does not surprise me. So this is an update of a story that we did 3 years ago. Since then, this family has lost two homes to foreclosure. They declared Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And I'm guessing that what struck a chord with listeners is that the Sinclairs told me that they want and deserve another mortgage.
Yeah, and this is what really angered listeners. The Sinclairs think that they're a good risk now because they can't declare bankruptcy again for another 7 years.
Right.
And that all of this has already taken a really heavy toll on the family. This is what Robert Godby of Laramie, Wyoming had to say.
I can imagine it was a very stressful experience and that they've paid the price, but the idea that history should be cast aside. What's the saying about history and when you're doomed to repeat it?
Yeah, it's a pretty good lesson, and Colleen Smith from San Diego was equally upset. She was actually surprised by how much this story upset her.
I bought a house in 2006. I got one of those awful ARM mortgages that required no down payment. I was just so tired of the indignities of renting that I just wanted a home of my own.
Let me guess, something happened to that house?
Well, she didn't borrow a lot of money to buy it, which is good, but she did get another job out of the state, and she couldn't sell the house. So she is now paying rent and paying a mortgage on her house.
And losing money?
Oh, you got it. But she says,
it's a problem that I made and I am responsible for. So these people really upset me. At no point did they ever think of themselves as responsible for the money they borrowed.
All right. Well, you know, I did reach out to Dan Sinclair this week once all those letters came in, and he wrote back that he understands why people are angry, and he agrees that homeowners like him were partially at fault for this housing crash. But he still wishes people would show a little more empathy. And he also wanted to point out that he did lose his entire life savings, including retirement, in all this. So he did pay a price.
Yeah, I know. It was such a crazy time. Yeah. And I'm so relieved now that I didn't buy a house then because,
right.
Oh, I was tempted. But as you heard earlier in the program, rental prices in L.A. are now out of control. So I just can't win.
Uh-oh.
Maybe I should move.
Don't do that. That'll cost you money, too.
Well, yeah, that is very true. And then I couldn't be doing this with you. So one last letter.
All right.
About something else entirely, aging parents and their finances.
Yeah, this is a topic that you covered with Steve Chiotakis a couple of weeks back and Penelope Wang over at Money Magazine.
Yeah, Robbie Bernstein from Cambridge, Massachusetts notes that even when you are smart with your money, you may not realize that your parents have made major mistakes until a problem arises.
However, as a result of one very big financial mistake she made, we did get involved and we put in place the appropriate financial and medical sharing of power documents, which authorities we needed immediately last fall when my mother-in-law had a stroke.
Well, glad they have that in place. You know, it really is important to get involved, even if the folks aren't too excited about you getting involved.
Right.
All right. Let us know your thoughts. There is Twitter. I'm at Radio Tess. There's our Facebook page. And, of course, now the old-fashioned way, comment at marketplace.org/money. Thanks, Megan.
Hey, no problem.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, actor and comedian Albert Brooks has written his first novel. It's called 2030. In it, cancer has been cured, and that means people are living a long, long time, and they're not sure what to do with themselves.
We have been set up to retire and, you know, you sort of sit. It was never set up to be productive.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Sonata Lee Narsis. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I am Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week. This is APM, American Public Media.